we build such a beautiful love for our child that I'm glad the grief didn't hit me all at once.
Hello, you're listening to The Rare Life. I'm your host, Madeline Cheney. Today we have our last official story episode of season 9 with Ashley Smith. In this episode, Ashley shares what it was like to find out that her newborn son had a rare syndrome, what that grieving process has been like, including what they grieve the most, which actually might surprise you, and what it was like to continue her career while her husband became the primary caregiver of their two children. We also talk about how one of the most beautiful aspects of having a child with disabilities is connecting with other parents and families in the community, which I just feel so deeply. And on that note, I just wanted to talk about our discussion groups for anyone who needs a refresher of what those are or if you haven't heard about them yet. So I like to describe our discussion groups as a book club, but for the Rare Life podcast, which I understand probably won't mean anything to people who have not been in a book club, but I have, and I love book clubs, and to me that just makes a lot of sense. So these groups were inspired by hearing listeners talking about episodes on social media and saying things like, oh, I just wish I had someone to talk to about this. And maybe if they don't have a partner at all, or if their partner is like so sick of hearing them tell them about it or whatever it is, I totally get it. These topics are intense and they're heavy and they're deep, and I feel like they need to be discussed with other people. So there was that, paired with getting questions from parents on how to meet and make friends with other disability parents. And that was kind of the birth of discussion groups, because it's those two things combined. So they're a way to chat about and explore the topics we cover in episodes while also developing friendships with people who get it. The groups are facilitated by amazing volunteer listeners, and I've heard that they are a lot of fun. And most times, the bulk of the time is spent chatting about life and resource sharing, etc., rather than discussing the actual episodes the whole time. And if you haven't listened to the most recent episodes, still go. They're super casual, and you can kind of hop on and off as life permits, or like have your video off and be caring for a child or whatever you need to do. The groups are held virtually every other Tuesday. We have two groups to choose from to make it easier for you to make it work with your schedule. One at 8 p.m. Central Standard Time, and another one 2 hours later at 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. The episodes being discussed, as much or as little as you guys decide, are always the two most recent ones. And our next one is coming up this Tuesday, the 14th, which means today's episode and last week's episode about mental load sharing will be the topic of discussion, which is fun because they kind of go together really well. So mark your calendars and sign up to get text or email reminders and the link to join in the show notes. There is a form down there linked, and it takes about 60 seconds or less to fill out. Also, as a PS, this week's meeting is our last one that is in season 9. We'll start season 10 mid-August, and during the off season, we will scale back a lot on discussion groups, and we'll hold one once a month. They'll be the first Tuesday of each month, so June 4th, July 2nd, and August 6th at 8 p.m. Central Standard Time, which is 6 p.m. Pacific Standard. Again, if you sign up in the link in the show notes, you will get reminders and links for those too. I hope that you join the ones that you're able to and that you find connection there. All right, a little more about Ashley and then we'll hop in. Ashley lives with her husband, Dylan, her 4-year-old daughter, Nora, and her 2-year-old son, Deacon, in Kansas City, Missouri. She is a lover of their family dog and of connecting with others in the community. All right, let's dive in. Hi, Ashley. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. So excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm so grateful that you are willing to come on. And I just think it'll be like a really cool conversation because I don't know a lot about your story. So this will be very like authentic, real life, like hearing this for the first time, and also like your perspective as far as like the roles that you and your husband have, like as far as like who's the primary caregiver, who's the working parent. And so I think this will just be a really fascinating story to hear. So I'm excited.
Yes.
I would love to start out per tradition with the first time that you had any idea that Deacon had any medical issues or disabilities?
Yes. Well, before I even go there, I just want to say I have always been a podcast girly, love podcasts. And when I found your podcast, I felt like I found my little corner of the internet in that community. And so I know I had reached out and said, I want to come on and share my story because I wanted the roles in which I play and my husband play to be represented, because they're not the gender stereotypical roles. And so I'm really excited to hopefully have someone listen and feel seen and represented. So yes. My son, Deacon, is 2.5 and our second. So we had a healthy pregnancy, had a daughter, and just complete bliss. And I think every parent going into having another child assumes the same is going to happen. And I had a very healthy pregnancy with Deacon. I think it's the 16-week sonogram where you are kind of holding your breath because they're looking at the lungs and the heart. And that's also when we found out if it was going to be a boy or a girl. And that's where we learned it was going to be a boy. And I think at that moment, that's when you can picture the future and having a son, and, you know, my husband being so excited to be the father of a boy. And so we weren't grieving then. It was a very healthy sonogram. And I remember late in my second trimester, I had a great relationship with my OB, and my two older sisters had had very complicated pregnancies, one on bed rest, hospitalized like for her entire third trimester. And so it was more saying, let's just like take another look. Yeah. I feel fine. Everything looks fine. Like, because of my family history, let's take another look. So I'm very thankful that she said yes. And that was late in my second trimester. And in the room, I thought everything was fine. And through the sonogram, and then my OB comes back and says, something really interesting. It could be wrong. It could be a mistake, but the limb length is very short, like under 1%. So the arms and the legs. But again, it could have just been a failed test. Let's repeat. And I went home. I talked to my husband and we weren't really sure what to do, but decided to go in and repeat the sonogram, and it showed up again. So when they had measured my belly, I was on track, but it wasn't until they looked at arms and legs that they said something might be up. And so they asked if we wanted to do additional genetic testing. And my husband was like, if it's not going to change the birth plan and change how we care for our child, I'm like, let's not do it.
Yeah, because they're kind of high risk too. Like, were you talking about like amniocentesis and things like that?
I don't remember what the initial thought was. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of things, you know, of course you Google.
Yeah.
No one should ever Google, but I but remember saying short limb length in a sonogram. What could that possibly mean? And I think what's interesting is I remember everyone telling me what I wanted to hear. Family saying, I'm sure everything's fine. Even my doctor, it might have just been a mistake. And it was one of my best friends who is a doctor. She goes, if they say there might be something, they're probably right. There's something up. And I remember being kind of angry at her.
Like, that's not what you're supposed to say. You're supposed to tell me everything's fine.
Yes, everything's going to be fine. But she was right. So yeah, I'm trying to remember what it was called, the second sonogram. That's when they really like look at everything very extensively. And that was kind of an optional choice. And heart, lungs, like everything looked fine. It was just short arms, short legs. We don't know. So my husband said, let's not do any further testing. And I decided that I wanted to. The stress of it all was really weighing on me. So we did what we could, which I think was eliminating Down syndrome. There's like a few things that we could test for and rule out or rule in. Mm-hmm. And those were all ruled out. So we didn't know.
I feel like there's often like these two sides, right? Of like the more realistic or just anxious side of us that's like, okay, it probably is something. Something probably is wrong, like your doctor friend. And there's this other side that's like, it's probably fine. Do you think that like your husband's, his hesitance to have the testing done, do you think that part of that too was like ignorance is bliss? Like, I don't really want to know if there is something, you know what I mean? Like, it's almost like I kind of want to stay in this state of like not knowing just in case there really is something.
Yeah. You know, that could be, you know, I think it's a different perspective of me carrying the child and like wanting to know everything's okay. Yeah. You build yeah. such a relationship with this little human inside of you that's growing. So I was just wanting to know. And yeah. you're right. I think when you hear, you know, regardless of a medical complication or not in your pregnancy, that a lot of times in the father role, until the baby's here, the baby's not here. So it's kind of like, right. let's just address it when he gets here.
Yeah. Like, why even worry if there's nothing we're going to do about it?
Yeah. And I think the way he positioned it, which made me feel so safe, was we are going to love this child no matter what. We are all in no matter what. We can take this on no matter what. So I did appreciate his reasoning, but we weren't aligned on that. I wanted to know everything was going to be okay.
That was tricky. And so when that other test came back negative, there really wasn't anything else to do at that point, right?
Yeah. You know, I think some of the other tests we could have had done took longer than I even had in the pregnancy left. Oh. I was already into the third trimester. There was no other test that could be done until he arrived. And at that point, it was like, the care is going to be the same. And so we'll find out when he gets here, which was obviously really scary. I had so much stress towards the end of that pregnancy, hemorrhoids, everything. I mean, it was like self-induced stress.
Yeah, just envisioning like, what could this possibly be?
But my birth experience was honestly like blissful. I hate to say that. It was so beautiful. And I remember when he arrived, I looked at my OB because she delivered and I said, is he okay? Is he okay? And she looked at me in the eyes and said, he's perfect. Mm-hmm. And I'll touch on that and how I felt about that response later when we found out his diagnosis.
Yeah.
And then how I feel about that response now, because I think that's a really beautiful story.
There's a lot to that, right? Yeah, I'm sure. I'm excited to hear that.
Because I think when I heard her say, he's perfect, what I took was he's healthy. He is perfect. He's perfect to me. But I took, we're good. He's healthy. Apgar test passed with flying colors. And I even remember my like social media announcement to everyone was, we have a healthy baby boy. It was like, we're in the clear. Everything's fine. And I wanted everyone to know. I still get that like reminder. Every year when I review what I posted when my son was born, we have a perfectly healthy baby boy. Thanks for your prayers. Everything's fine.
Like, oh, man. And you probably felt so relieved. Oh, like, okay, there's nothing scary. Like, we're good.
Yes, it was relief. We're good. Everything's fine. And that obviously turned out not to be the case.
So what happened next?
So hour 24, I get woken up. It's early in the morning. And they say, we're moving him up to the NICU. He's not breathing on his own. So thankfully it was a nurse that was listening to his oxygen and checking that and saw that it was below the levels it should be. And so I wake up, he's up in the NICU, we head up, and I remember getting to the room and seeing him, and they had asked, you know, when's the last time he's eaten? And, you know, within those first 24 hours, my experience, my nurses, everyone was really relaxed. Like, he wasn't latching like my daughter did. I mean, there was like this strength in her, and she latched and sucked and was breastfeeding well. And with Deacon, he didn't latch really. And he was really like, there wasn't a strength to it. And I just thought, oh, he's going to be this like sweet, soft little guy, you know? And I don't think he was getting any food for the first 24 hours. But the nurses kind of go, it's fine. They'll figure it out and give it time. Well, when we were up in the NICU, oxygen low, I said, he probably hasn't really eaten. They feed him through a feeding tube. And I remember like almost like yelling, this wasn't part of my plan. Right? I mean, you write out your birth plan, you tell the doctors and the nurses, and so many of us expecting mothers do this. We write out what we want to happen. And for a lot of us, we are not in control. I remember they sent in, oh, who was it? Like, they'll have these at hospitals and they'll send in like a service worker or a
social worker.
Thank you. They brought in a social worker. So after I yelled, this is not my plan.
You like verbally yelled it. I was thinking that was like in your head.
I verbally yelled to all. There were at least 6 to 8 people in the room, nurses, and, you know, they had already been feeding him. And then I think they'd given him a pacifier, and I'd put in my plan, no pacifier.
So that was like the final straw. You're like, no,
this is not my plan. So they did bring in a social worker, I feel like, to like calm me down and mediate the situation. But I just spiraled.
I feel like that's so interesting. It was like the pacifier was like the final thing, because I think it is like you go from being in control as the parent to like not having hardly any say over their care, which is so bizarre. And especially, I know how you feel too, with like you already had another child, like you've been in the driver's seat as a parent before. And so to have that just like ripped away and like, no, we're taking over. We're shoving the feeding tube down his throat. We're like bringing him upstairs. I don't know. I just feel like all those things, it just feels like the way that we typically experience parenthood was kind of ripped away from you in that moment. And I can see why there was so much anger at that. Like, no, this is not part of my plan.
You're absolutely right. It was all the control of how I care for my child within not even 24 hours. I wasn't in the caretaker role for my child.
Yeah.
It was like someone else is feeding him. And I think we'll get to that, because he was on a feeding tube for the first 2 years of his life. And as a mother, not being able to feed your child, that was ripped away. And that was really difficult. And that happened day one.
It's hard when something like that, that's usually such like a almost instinctual or like basal thing, right? Like feeding your newborn baby, and especially when you're breastfeeding, where it goes from that vision of feeding them that way over to a very medicalized, pretty traumatic way of feeding. I mean, I have some intense medical trauma just from like shoving the feeding tube down his throat while he's screaming. And like, it's just such a contrast. It's such a contrast to what it quote unquote should be, right? Like naturally.
Yes, the whole feeding journey when you're not able to feed your child, whether it is breastfeeding, whether it is preparing food to give them by mouth, right? I mean, that is stripped away when you have a child on a feeding tube. And that happened very early on in our parenting journey with Deacon.
Yeah, that's so hard.
And then they did every test that they could at that hospital. We were there for almost a week, and they looked at his heart and his lungs and everything. And he looked healthy. He just wasn't able to breathe on his own. When they'd try to take off the oxygen, his levels would drop. And so we were just in this waiting period to get to another hospital in the city to be transferred for a bed to open up where they had more specialists to look at Deacon. And so it took about a week to get transferred to this larger hospital. And that was the first time you're experiencing those rounds is really overwhelming with all of the doctors. But we had this big, cozy room to ourselves. And then when we were transferred to this larger NICU, we had 2 sheets, maybe 7 feet by 7 feet, a chair. And you know, at this point, I'm 10 days post-delivery. And I'm sure every mother that's had a child in the NICU, you go from laying in your bed, getting food delivered to you. And then, you know, even day one, I was just going up and down to the NICU, you know, not really getting that bonding time. There was nowhere for us to really be together. So we get to this larger hospital and just the rounds, it's very overwhelming. You're waiting around all day and then 8 to 10 doctors come in for a few minutes. We were just trying to figure out why he can't breathe, why he can't breathe. And every specialist is looking at him, same story. Everything looks fine, heart, lung, I mean, everything. And then he just started breathing on his own. He just kind of figured it out.
Wow.
But I still hear the beeping because when his levels would get too low, their beep would go off. And so hearing that for those 10 days, it's like, I hear a beep. And anyone who's had a feeding tube, that's you hear that beep and it's like triggering.
Yeah.
But the geneticist came by and it was like, okay, do you think he's fine? And she's like, I do think he is. And I, at that point, pushed for genetic testing.
That's good.
I said, I know he's breathing on his own. We've been here 10 days. We've been at 2 hospitals. I didn't want to leave without every stone unturned, you know?
I think that's so interesting that they didn't say that, right? Like with all those professionals and specialists that they weren't saying, let's look at his genetics. I think that's so great that you like asserted yourself and was like, no, we're going to do this before we leave. Like we need answers, like you say.
Yes. And I think getting kind of the tip when I asked for a second sonogram in my second trimester, that like I had done enough Googling to know I better make sure there isn't something genetically going on here.
It's like you were aware.
I was aware of the possibilities. Yeah. And I so appreciate that geneticist because she goes, we are in the NICU. Sometimes that's hard to get approved. She said, this is the best chance to get that done. We're here. It's wrapped into the care that he's getting now. Like, this is the best time to do it. Let's just do it. And that was kind of a roller coaster as well, because what we got to was a multi-step whole genome sequencing. I think it's called WGS for short. So it was kind of in phases. So a few weeks would go by, everything looks fine. But we're going to do another like round. And so I had gotten a couple calls that everything looked fine. And then 12 weeks after we had left the NICU, I got the call with our diagnosis.
And they told you the diagnosis over the phone?
They did.
I think that's interesting. They told us in person, but that sounds like such a hard phone call to receive.
What was interesting is there was this geneticist that had made those first couple calls that like everything looks fine, but we're going to do like another panel or another step. And so I had just gotten home from work and she had called me with the results. And I was like, I'm in the middle of something. I can't talk right now. Just can you call me tomorrow? I think about that. I'm like, wouldn't you have wanted to know? So I probably just wasn't ready. So I do appreciate that our pediatrician called me that next morning.
Oh, yeah.
And I'll never forget, like, it was this full body rush of like, my temperature was like 200 degrees. And I just sat down and she said, your son has ADNP and she's researching it along with us. I mean, she had never heard of his diagnosis before. And at the time, he was the youngest to ever be diagnosed at just 12 weeks old or 13 weeks at that time. And so that's also a little, you don't know what to grieve. And your doctor doesn't even, has never given this diagnosis before. There were only one and a deacon was one and I think 300 children at the time. It's grown since then. I don't think it's as rare. I think we're just learning a lot more about genetic mutations and deletions.
Yeah. Was she able to tell you just from like any amount of research of like what usually goes along with that?
She directed me to the ADNP Foundation page, which I was so thankful. It was actually the mother of the first child ever diagnosed.
Wow.
which how amazing to start a foundation. And so I felt so comforted. And that was because of a mother who had gotten the same diagnosis as me 8 years ago. And when she researched it, she found nothing because no one in the world had had it. And so I just am so thankful for a brave, bold mother that came before me that said, there's going to be resources and community when you do Google what this is.
Shout out, right? Shout out to all the parents who've done that type of thing. Because I think like a lot of us, I think probably with like just technology advancing, right? There are these kind of newer syndromes, quote unquote, but like newer as far as us having the knowledge of them and stuff and our and children being able to survive them, right? With like with the technology now. And so like we are standing in the shade of a lot of trees that have been planted on our behalf. And I know a lot of people, even like this generation or whatever, like our age, like are also planting trees for people that will be after them. But I just think it's such a beautiful legacy to leave and to help another parent out that comes after. What a gift.
Yeah. And you're doing that with your podcast. And it's amazing. I think that's been one of the most beautiful things about getting this diagnosis is the community and meeting so many brave parents who we help us not feel as alone, you know, and to find community. And it's been really nice to experience that the last couple of years.
Yeah, I agree. That is one of the coolest things for sure. It's quite an honor to be like a part of this club that's a lot of amazing people.
Yeah, I always call it we're on the road less traveled.
Yep.
We're on it together.
Yes. Okay, sorry. I sidetracked from your story of like, so you looked up the website for the foundation and then you were able to have like some amount of information of like what to expect.
Yes. So thankfully, I had this foundation page to go to. I see there's 300 children in the world with this diagnosis at the time. And I actually even had to write some of this down. It's a neurodevelopmental disorder that's non-hereditary, a non-hereditary genetic mutation or deletion. So Deakin's was a mutation. And it's of the ADNP gene, which is one of the most vital genes in the brain. Without the gene, the brain doesn't even develop. And so it impacts really every function of the body. I think when doing the research, we didn't know what to agree because the range of impact was widespread. Some children walked, some never walked. Some children talked, many never talked. And I think at the time, you're kind of grieving. You don't know what to grieve. And I also couldn't even comprehend anything beyond walking and talking. And I think what's unique is, you know, Deakin has global developmental delays and it's linked to autism. So with almost all children, they also have an autism diagnosis. And then there's a whole kind of sensory processing component. So I didn't know to grieve. I can't be at a birthday party when we sing happy birthday. I have to go down to the basement, right? Mm-hmm. I couldn't even fathom the degree of impact beyond walking and talking. I mean, that was devastating enough, but it's so much more than that.
Yeah.
But I couldn't process more than that at that time.
Right. Well, it's like, you can't even fathom how many different ways that disability and medical complexities can like affect so many aspects of your life, right? Like you say, like even like the birthday party songs, like how you have to leave during that. Like, I think it's just when you've only known life with a healthy child that develops typically, like it's just so hard to even wrap your brain around like how much it impacts. Because I think like when we see disabled people like out and about in the world, like usually it has something to do with like, you know, they're non-ambulatory, so they're not walking, or they're non-verbal, so they're not talking. And that's kind of, we like see that and then we like go along our day, but we just don't, it feels very like, not secretive, but not very represented unless you like know someone really closely that's living that life. And so I think that makes sense that you like didn't even know all the ways that it would impact you. And I imagine that's really elongated your processing of it, where you're just kind of like, things are coming up as he's getting older. And you're realizing things like, oh, you know, that makes me really sad. And I didn't even know that this would be in our future.
Yes. Even like being able to wave, you know, hi or bye, or kind of socially engage. And I think every parent of a child with medical, you know, complexities, the grief, it can hit you at any moment. Like for me, it hit me at a birthday party, a joyful event. And I think we all experience grief along the journey, but we build such a beautiful love for our child that I'm glad the grief didn't hit me all at once. You know, week 13, mm-hmm. I can take it on over time as I develop this like deep love and knowing of my child. You know, he cannot say a word, but he communicates. But that's been built up through his whole life. And so I think that eases the pain of the grief over time, because my love for him just grows deeper and deeper.
Oh, yes. No, I love that. I think that makes so much sense, because I think when you find out a lot of things, like if you had known everything at the beginning, it is kind of hard. We were like, here's like this little tiny baby that I don't super know yet. And then I'm like projecting what his life will be like, what would that be like if we never could be at birthday parties while they're singing, to use that example. And I think that that can sound a lot bleaker when you're not aware of like the person that comes along with that, right? Like that relationship. And so I love how you phrase that, because I think that like our children, I think I've said this before, but I really feel like our children, like our relationship with them and our love for them really is comforting, right? Like while we're grieving things that they're going through and we're going through, like it also is like such a, I don't know, just that relationship and like that bond is just so nurturing. Often we nurture our children, but I do think that love is very nurturing to us and our pain and our grief that we're experiencing.
Absolutely. Yes. And even the fact that he can't verbalize, he gives me a look and he communicates, and I feel love through that. And you don't know that you're going to feel that when you first find out. And so even what you think you're grieving, even if you do have the awareness of what a specific challenge is going to be based on your diagnosis, it might not feel as dark when you're in it, because like for me, Deacon expresses love and joy and communicates, even though we can't vocalize. And I wouldn't have had that awareness, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that really resonates. Like I think of it as like a small diagnosis compared to like other things in this community, but like Kimball's hard of hearing. And so like when we found out, it was really hard for me. I think partially just like, oh, the hassle of like maybe learning ASL and like doing hearing aids or cochlear implant, all that stuff. And I didn't know to envision too, like a 5-year-old little boy who adores his hearing aids and pops up every morning like, Mom, put my hearing aids in, and like the funny things that he'll say when he can't hear us when they're not in. And I don't know, it's like you don't get the whole picture. And I know that's not always how it ends up being, but I do think that like a lot of our assumptions at the beginning might add a lot of pain and grief when they're not necessarily accurate assumptions of what it's going to be like. And it still was very hard. I think that's another thing, is like the duality of like, it's not necessarily like I thought it was gonna be so hard, and then it actually has been super great. Like it was really hard at the beginning, like getting him used to the hearing aids and like just being sad that he couldn't hear us unless they were in, and they're falling out all the time and just things like that. But I think like the assumptions we make at the beginning really can add needless anxiety or like sadness or grief.
Yes. And I think one thing to add to that, and almost like a caution, if you are a parent who just received your child's diagnosis, and I think along with the grief, you're already trying to process what to grieve, and that's difficult. And then for me, I was so thankful to have, like, there was a family Facebook page set up, which was absolutely wonderful from the standpoint of knowledge. Like I learned so much about what to ask a specialist, what specialist to go to, all of that. The one thing is, then I was grieving the future of what I was seeing. If I would see a parent sharing a really difficult challenge with aggression at 13, I was holding my 6-month-old baby, starting to grieve that.
Yeah.
And so I had to kind of scale back a little bit and say, there's so much good out of this community of connection and knowledge, but I had to like check myself, because then I was starting to grieve maybe 13-year-old Deacon. And that was too much. Yeah. I'm learning to just enjoy where we're at, gain community and knowledge, but not get too far ahead of myself.
That's so wise. Yes. No, I think there's so much value to what you're saying. And I think like really grounding yourself in like, this is where we are right now. Like I have enough complications and difficult things to figure out right now, right? I don't need to add future worries that won't even necessarily come true, right? Like
yeah.
With these genetic diagnoses, like you really don't know how it's going to pan out and how it's going to present for your child specifically and how you might feel. I think even if you had a child exactly like this other mom's, like maybe you wouldn't feel exactly the same way as she would. There's just like a million factors. So I think that's super wise to not let yourself get too far into like projecting their reality onto like yourself now and your future. Just kind of focus on the now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, when we received Deacon's diagnosis at 13 weeks, I had just gone back to work. And, you know, I think there's this conversation of, you know, maternity leave, it's so short and we're not given much of it. And then to add on a diagnosis.
Yeah.
In the mix of that, like you don't get a maternity leave extension. There's no grace for that. And
yeah.
Your job needs you back and the expectations come. And I was days back into my full-time corporate role. I had maxed out all of my time off. So I remember that being a really stressful time for our family as well, trying to navigate that yeah. as you're coming off of maternity leave and jumping back into my corporate role, you know?
I'm sure. I've never experienced that. What was that like to suddenly be like dressing up again and going into the office and seeing your coworkers and the people you work with and being like, I mean, I imagine I'm projecting this on you, but like, my life is so different from when I was working here before I had Deacon, right? Like everything's changed now about like my life now and like my vision of my future. Like, what was that like?
Yes. You know, I was still working from home with the pandemic. I mean, it was 2021, but
oh, okay.
We had not gone back to the office. And so I was working at home at the time, but everything you said about, I am not the same. My life is not the same. My obligations are not the same. And then to have to show up like everything was very, very challenging. And, you know, at the time we had sent Deacon with his sister to an in-home daycare of the husband and wife. You know, they'd watched our daughter for years. And so Deacon was there. And that was our plan. Dylan, my husband, was working. I was working full time. And, you know, that was going on before we got the diagnosis. So they were in care. I had gone back to work and this was before we had our diagnosis. And so when you receive the diagnosis, we are so thankful that we had so much support and resources and therapy. So, you know, we were getting ready to enroll him in OT, PT, speech, in home, at a therapy center. And so we pulled them out of that care so, you know, we could get all the help and send him to all the things. And so I think, like so many families, when you receive this diagnosis, and this is one of the best things that came from that family community, is that I connected with another mom. And she had called me and said, the best thing my husband and I ever did is one of us decided to stay at home and dedicate themselves to our child's care. We were going to give him the best opportunity to reach his full potential. And that's what we did. And I feel like you should do that too.
Oh, wow.
And I went to my husband and said, I think this is what we need to do. I think one of us needs to stay at home. And he agreed. And, you know, we took on our roles for what was needed of the family and for our son. And so, you know, I was carrying the benefits. And so I stayed at work and he dedicated himself to being home with Deacon. And I think that was so difficult because he had to sacrifice his career that he loved, that he had built for over a decade. And of course, he did it so willingly for the love of his son, but that was very difficult. And for me, on the flip side, the provider that's going from a two-income household to the single provider, that's a lot of pressure. And I knew I needed to step up into the role to give us the ability to access all of these resources and have insurance and all the things. But everything had changed, but I still had to show up in a job like nothing had changed. And then kind of the added pressure of, I'm a mother with this diagnosis and I want to nurture, but I have to provide. And I think that created a little bit of resentment, because I think we would have wanted to be in the other role, you know, if we could, but that wasn't what was possible for our family. And so I think at the time we took on roles that were needed of us, but I think we resented the other's roles for a while. And I think that was really difficult.
Yeah, that's so tricky. Like, it's like your innate desires were flipped from like what made most sense financially and like stability wise.
Yeah.
That sounds really, really hard. And especially like when you first find out your child's diagnosis and stuff, like that is such a tumultuous time, like emotionally and like physically and just like all the things, like, and then to, like you said, for him to lose his career that he loved and like probably have a lot of like identity wrapped up in, and then like for you to feel the added pressure and to be like, well, I wish I could be doing that. Like, that just sounds like such a big layer to add to everything that you guys were adjusting to and going through.
Yeah, it was the most difficult time for our family and our relationship, hands down. And I think when we look back on it now and what we've learned about ourselves is we're in the best roles for our family. I mean, my husband, he's so patient and nurturing. And, you know, I think about when Deacon was on his feeding tube. I mean, for many, many, many months, he was on a 20-hour continuous feed. I'm sure there's parents listening to this who have gone through that as well. And you're waking up every few hours at night to change it. And he did all of that. It was like, you need to wake up and go to work in the morning. I've got this. And we kind of divided and conquered and owned our roles. It was like, I was showing up in a very high pressure, big responsibility, corporate role. And he gave me the ability to do that, to keep showing up while he was like taking it all on at home. So that was so much for him. And then I was also feeling this guilt and resentment that like I wasn't there doing that for my son and caring for my son. But I'm so thankful to have a partner that just stepped up and did it all. And something we haven't even touched on is the support that comes around you when you're going through this. And when we found out Deacon's diagnosis, some people in our family didn't want to acknowledge that it was even something serious. Hmm. Like, oh, he'll probably be fine. He's going to be fine. Everything's going to be fine.
It's like probably those same people when you're pregnant, where you're like, but now we know it's not fine. So why are you still saying that?
So that was it, that we didn't even have that community that was really acknowledging what we were going through. Yeah. So I'm sure, you know, my husband through a lot of that felt like that caretaker role was solely on him, as I felt like that provider role was solely on me. I think we both felt a lot of loneliness and a lot of like resentment through that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Because I think like, if you both were working parents and you both then like shared the tasks, like when you got home or like part-time or whatever, you know, I think there would be a lot more of like feelings of like, oh, we're just doing the same things together. But for it to be like, we're dividing and conquering, like you say, like, which can be very effective. And it sounds like it's worked really well for you guys. I think that does, it does feel more lonely because you can't relate as well with each other. Your whole lives are very different from each other's.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think if there's anyone going through that, like the challenge of that, I think what really helped us is we got to a point where we knew our strengths, like we were in the role where our strengths were, and we actually owned and acknowledged that. And we so appreciated the strength of our partner. Like, I know, you know, my husband is so patient and nurturing, and he is right for this role. And we no longer wished we were in the other seat, or even sometimes like assumed the other had it better. I don't know if that even makes sense. Sometimes we think the other one has it easier, the other one has it better, and that can be so difficult. And I think we've been able to really appreciate each other's strengths, respect each other's roles, feel so proud of the team that we are, and it's just bettered our family. And of course, there can still be tough days and tough moments, but I think about where we were when we had to make that decision 2 years ago and where we are in our relationship and our family now. And there's just a lot more respect and joy and love that is felt in our home.
I love that. I think that's so cool. And I think, like, I'm guessing that a lot of that respect too comes from knowing that the other person wanted the other role, right? Of being like, oh, like my wife really wishes that she could be the one home, or like, oh, my husband wishes he could still be in his career. Yeah. And yet look what they're sacrificing for our family. And I think that that can give so much respect for the other person when you're like, I'm so grateful that they're tackling this and they're doing so well at it. And look how well our family is functioning because of those sacrifices and the ways that they've like put that effort in. I think that's just, that's so cool. Not to like totally like change the subject, but I also want to hear how things went with your daughter, right? Because I've kind of been thinking about her within this story, and obviously all these things are impacting her as well. Like, what has this been like for her, and how has it like impacted your relationship with her and her relationship with her dad and Deacon? Like, how has that gone down?
It's such a good question. And it's funny, you know, we are doing this podcast right after the bedtime routine rush. And I think I heard my husband say, the hardest thing about Deacon's diagnosis is that Nora doesn't have a brother to play with. Yeah. You know, Nora is 4.5 and Deacon's 2.5. And I'm sure, like, you know, many mothers out there who were pregnant at the same time as their friends, you know, I was. I have so many friends out there with children 4 and 2. So I see all the time the bond and the playfulness between two. And I think that's the thing we grieve the most. Wow. That we didn't even know to grieve. From back to like what you can't even grieve when you get the diagnosis, or what you grieve too much of that you shouldn't, you know? Yeah. We didn't know to grieve that. And that's been the hardest part. We kind of say, we feel like we have two only children. It's like having two only children. It's so much work. There's not a level of play and interaction yet. And, you know, Nora's young enough that it's like Deacon's her baby brother, you know? And I think something, I went to this event, a mother with a couple special needs children too spoke, and she said, you set the tone for your children on if like caring for your child is a burden. And so we always have the mentality that like we approach everything with love and enthusiasm. And I'm so glad I heard that, and that stuck with me, is that even through the feeding tube and everything, like you never vocalize anything in a way that's like, oh, this is so hard or so much work. Like, I think she has this awareness that she has this vibrant baby brother, but he's just a baby. She hasn't acknowledged that he has really any delays, even though he's not walking, he's not talking, he's 2.5. And so I'm sure those conversations will come, but they haven't come yet. But I wish he had a brother to play with, you know?
Right. So it's like she hasn't super caught on yet that she's missing out on like a more typical relationship. But you know, you're seeing your friends and their kids and like, okay, I can see how it might have been and what I'm sad, you know, they're missing out on, even if she doesn't realize she's missing out on it yet.
Yeah. And I think for us, it's, you know, I think before we knew Deacon's diagnosis, it was, we'll have two children and we'll be done. You know, perfect little family of four, white picket fence. And for us, I actually feel like because of this topic of, you know, wanting your children to have these sibling relationships. I came from one of four, that I think it's opened us up to wanting to have more children. And it took us a while to get there. We had to feel like if we received a diagnosis, we'd be ready to take it on. And it makes us want to grow our family. For our son, too, to have this community of siblings, and especially with some of his sensory processing, you know, just challenges, that he will have this community in his family. And I think we have this desire to grow that, and for our daughter, too. You know, she's always asking for a sister to play with. And we're so thankful for her cousin. She just adores her cousin. So she has that outlet. But that's probably the hardest part of it all.
Yeah. That's so interesting. Because I think, like, we want to give our children, you know, all the things that they deserve or they want. And as a parent, you know, because you love them. And so I think that makes sense that you're like, I want to give that to her. Like, I want her to be able to experience this thing that I experienced and that I pictured her experiencing. And so I've heard that a lot, that people who, like, they initially wanted two kids and they're like, oh, actually, maybe we'll add another child in there, which is so interesting, because it's like, obviously, it's a really big deal, right? Like, having, whether you decide to have like two children or three or one or whatever, like, that's a really personal big decision. But I do think that, like, we're equipped to make those kind of choices, right? Like, I think also just like the awareness where you're like, we need to be okay with like the possibility of having a child with even just a whole different syndrome or disability, because until you've experienced it, it does kind of feel like, well, that just happens to other people. And then once you've experienced it, you're like, no, this can happen to anyone. And so I think, like, that's really wise too, to be like, we have to be okay with that like possibility, because it happens.
Absolutely. And we felt like unless we'd be okay with it, like, we couldn't, because, you know, once you've been this like one in a million, don't you ever go to a doctor? It's like, well, it's a really slim chance that this could happen. And you're like, well, there's a chance.
Try me.
Like, if there's a 0.01% chance, this is a legitimate chance. And I need to like know about this. So just your, even the way you approach something when someone says it's rare, it's like, well, that could happen to me or my friends. And that took us a long time to feel like if that happened again, we'd be able to take it on again. But also, when you have a child that you realize you might care for forever, like, we don't know. There is one of the oldest diagnosed individuals with ADNP does live on his own, very close to his mother over in Europe. And so I think that gives some families hope in that. But I mean, sometimes you go, I might parent and nurture and care forever. It's like, we're in this. This is our role and our duty forever now. And maybe wanting a little bit of abundance in that. I think that's where we're at, even though it sounds impossible to like actually imagine taking on more than we already are.
I think it's interesting to think about, because you're like, well, the way you're living right now probably felt impossible at the beginning too. So it's like, I think you also learn a lot about yourself, and you're like, I can take a lot on. Like, I'm pretty resilient. Like, I was able to adjust to this, and we found our new normal and stuff. And so, like, I remember feeling the same way of being like, oh, we could have another child with CDPX1, my son's syndrome, and being like, I mean, we already learned all about it. So, like, it'd be easier for us to have a child with that than, like, anyone else, just because, like, the learning curve has been learned. I mean, obviously, it's not going to be easy, and it'd be really hard and things like that. But it's an interesting, like, dichotomy.
Yeah, I have a former kind of dance teammate. We follow each other on social media. And her daughter was born with a rare genetic disorder. And then they adopted another girl with medical complexities. And I don't know what her diagnosis is. But kind of to your point, it's like, I think they felt equipped in that and went the adoption path. And I thought that was so beautiful. And now they're expecting their fourth.
Oh, wow.
And it's just a beautiful story to have that like mindset, like, we are now equipped and we can help another child. It's really beautiful.
Yeah, it really is.
But I think back to Nora and her relationship with Deacon, I think there's like one more thing I want to add on that. I think I've talked about the grief of her not having this sibling just to run around and play with and interact with. But we do a lot to really foster engagement, so even though he can't communicate, just like creating a relationship with them and being kind of intentional in how we guide them to that. And just the other day, I plopped them in the bath together. And Deacon is so good at lifting his head when I pour the water on his head. I say, look up. And he looks up and lets me pour the water on his hair so perfectly. And my daughter, who's 4 and a half, just despises it, shrieks. She doesn't want the water in her face. She looks down and the water falls in her eyes and she cries and it's so difficult. And I find those moments to say, Deacon is really good at this, and highlighting his strength, even if they're little things. You could learn a lot from Deacon in this. Do you see how he holds his head back? Look how good he is. And of course, then she gets so competitive. Well, I can be as good as Deacon. I can be better than Deacon. And that was the first time in the bath she lifted her head perfectly, and we got through a bath without tears. And so I really find the moments where I can tell her that she can learn a lot from Deacon. And even her little 4-year-old boys, well, you know, I'm the big sister. I won't learn anything from him. And I looked at her and I said, Deacon's going to teach you a lot. And he will. He's going to teach her a lot. He's teaching all of us a lot. And just to really foster that her brother can also be a leader. Her brother can teach her. And being really mindful of like how you can find those moments, because you kind of have to really be intentional about it.
I think that's so awesome. I really love picturing that. And yeah, I think like it probably helps the other sibling like have a new level of respect for them in a way, instead of just like, oh, he can't do this and he can't do that. But to see like, no, like he's very capable and just like his own ways. I think that's a really awesome way to kind of like shine a light on that and help her like form that bond with him and learn from him. I think that's such a profound thing. Well, I am so grateful for your willingness to share your story. I know there's going to be so many aspects of it that will resonate with other people. And I would love to wrap up with just your final words to people who may be listening and are in the beginning parts of their grieving process or are just newly adjusting to everything and feel like, I don't think I'll ever get to the point that she's in where she's just got this and their family's doing it and like, I just don't think I'll ever get there. Like, what would you want to say to those people?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, we have challenges. So every week there's something where we can be at a high and then at a low, you know? So we've grown and learned so much over the last couple of years, but it is such a journey. And I think what I want those who might just be finding this podcast or newly diagnosed is, I think we can all admit that before we received this diagnosis, for a lot of us, we would have said it is one of a parent's worst nightmares to receive a diagnosis like this, right? I think I would have stated that.
Yeah.
That's worst case scenario. And what I have found is that it's not, like, it doesn't feel like that living in it. Outside looking in, pre-diagnosis, you know, I think I'd see that and go, oh, that is so difficult. You know, I could never take that on. And I think what I want people to know is that I feel like my understanding of my role in this world, of what life is about, has expanded in such a beautiful way that I am being molded into such a better person and a mother and a partner because of Deacon. And I am thankful for my faith that allows me to know that this was not an accident. This was God's plan for my life. And his intentions for my life are good. He wants the best for my life. And I don't think life was meant to be easy. I'm sure all of us feel like, gosh, I just wish it could be easier. I mean, I would struggle. I couldn't even connect with moms who didn't have a disability diagnosis for a while because I like envied them. I mean, it was very unhealthy. Oh, well, your life's easy. Like, I had to distance myself. I could only connect with moms that I thought, or families that had it as hard as I did. And then you realize that we weren't made for easy. We were made for more. And I feel when things get really hard, they're hard, but I also feel a deeper, more expansive joy in life because of Deacon. You know, like, he's in his little walker and he's learning to take steps in his walker. And the amount of joy I feel when I see him progress is unlike anything I've ever felt before. And without Deacon, I think I would have been really focused on what I was taught to prioritize is performance. You know, your kids need to get the 4.0. They need to be the star player. They need to be first chair in the band. That's how I was raised. And I think I might have repeated that. Thank goodness I am Deacon's mom. Thank goodness I have learned and grown of like what the purpose of life is, and to treat everyone with respect, and to focus on giving of ourselves and loving everyone. And I know I am lucky to be on this journey of being Deacon's mom. It is hard, but it is still an honor and a privilege. And I think my husband and I like kind of like boast about that. We're like, yeah, look at Deacon. He is rare and amazing and perfectly imperfect. And like, we can take it on. And like, we kind of like flex a little bit with other parents.
Totally a flex.
It's like, oh, you think that's hard? We've been through 10 times that. And like, we've gone through it on the other end. I mean, you're never through it, right? This is going to be forever.
Like, I'm still standing.
Yeah. It's like the most beautiful view is like at the hardest climb. And for us, the last 2 years were the hardest climb of our life. And we've grown through that, and trust that there will be beauty and joy. You will be molded into strength. Beautiful people will come into your life through it. And also have grace with yourself when you do feel all the worst emotions ever. Why me, poor me? Because that's also going to come.
Yeah.
And so it's okay to also not be okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, I love that so much. I'm just so excited for people to hear that. I think that I needed to hear that in my early days. I wish I could have heard that in the beginning. And I'm sure you think the same thing. I wish you could like go back in time and tell your past self all those things, because I think it just has so much hope. And I agree with everything you said. Thank you so much again.
Thank you for the opportunity. Again, I'm so happy I found your little corner of the internet. And thank you for giving me a space to share my story and kind of speak to other families who might want to feel seen. And I'm just very thankful.
Yes, of course. Thank you. You can find links in the show notes to connect with me and with Ashley on social media. Also, follow the link in the show notes to sign up for a text or email reminder, as well as to receive the link to join our discussion groups. A huge thank you to all the hands that helped in making this episode, including and especially our producer, Alyssa Newtile, who helps us get every episode all polished and ready to go in time for release each week. And a huge thank you to everyone who has contributed monetarily, either by donating or sharing fundraisers in the past. You guys help make it possible. Join us next week for our last official episode of season 9, all about having a non-disabled child after your disabled child, with guest Brianna Alcox. It is such a relatable one. Don't miss it. See you then.